Jeffrey, and this is the Passionate About OSS podcast. The purpose of the podcast is to shine a light on the brilliant minds of the OSS and telco industry, to describe their background, but also to share some of their fantastic knowledge, tips, and techniques. Today's episode, we'll take a look at the challenges and pitfalls awaiting OSS implementation teams. Today's guest has a deep affinity for OSS. You could say he's probably as passionate about OSS as I am. He's been in the game for nearly 20 years and has worked across many of the different facets that make up OSS and BSS implementations. He was a founding director of Dynamic Design Australia, where he took an established OSS company and product and started up the Australian subsidiary. At Dynamic Design Australia, he was responsible for identifying opportunities, making the sale, signing off on pricing, and then also was deeply involved in the implementation. In many organizations, there's a handoff of responsibility across all those silos, but our guest was accountable across delivery completely from go to work. And that experience makes him ideally suited to talk about implementation challenges. I'm delighted to have him on the episode because typically our 15-minute chats always devolve into a two-hour conversation about OSS implementation problems, workarounds, solutions. So welcome today to Michael De Boer.
Thank you very much, Ryan. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you on. So for the guests, Michael and I first met around 10 years ago when he was the service delivery manager for Pitney Bowes, a company known for their MapInfo GIS, which is used in quite a lot of OSS globally. So that was an Australian role, but was it also the first to take you onto international implementation projects, Michael?
Yeah, look, that role had some international exposure, but still very much Australia-based. But definitely my first piece of work outside of an actual telco environment. So, you know, either in construction or in operations of a network. So first time I was on the vendor side, which is really exciting.
Yeah, completely different view and perspective on how implementation projects work from that side.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's a lot more accountability when you're sitting on the vendor side as opposed to on the customer side.
Yeah, you bet. But your OSS journey goes back almost a decade further than that. So prior to Pitney Bowes, you spent time working with VisionStream and NextGen. Are you able to describe a little bit about those symbiotic companies and what some of your roles entailed there?
So, yeah, very early days, I was really just supporting a lot of administration around VisionStream's copper rehab programs and network deployment programs for Telstra. But that, with my software background, that quickly folded into business process systems and eventually started doing a fair bit of development in there as well, helping support their design tools, et cetera. So that was a bit of my initial start, but then heavily involved with the NextGen Networks design and construction team, and then later on operations. So a nice opportunity to work on building networks. And then, you know, as we've discussed before, working in the operational environments, challenging, but rewarding in its own rights.
Mm. And you would have crossed across many of the different facets of OSS-BSS in terms of the tooling, the functionality in doing those roles, so across inventory, across assurance.
Yeah, so one of the areas that I picked up really early in NextGen's D&C was asset management, which very quickly rolled into inventory management. Mm. So obviously they're rolling out a large network, putting in a number of assets. So the first bit was making sure that we'd accounted for all of the assets, and I was writing various tools and systems to help pull that together and then managing those tools.
So some off-the-shelf tools, and you were doing some of the glue to bring the pieces together? Or?
No, originally NextGen was probably a little light on some of those tools. So a lot of it was sitting in Excel, et cetera. So I was consolidating them into databases and building some front ends to help manage them. And then later on, their inventory system was being implemented, and then it was a reasonably fast mapping for them to bring me over to the inventory side. And that was my first exposure to network inventory, where we were implementing very early version of SpatialNet. And I had all the data. And it was about them building up those models into, yeah, a relational database, which is inventory, would model all of the network that NextGen had built. So yeah, that was sort of my introduction into inventory. Never really turned back from that, but also later on, then when I moved into operations, got great exposure to network management, service management, which are also, you know, once again, anything that really involves software, I had a real passion for, especially on the operational systems, finding ways to be more efficient and making life easier when the stresses of faults and challenges in the network occur, being able to get to that information and deal with the issues as quickly as possible actually really excited me.
You touched on earlier on about Copper Rehab as well, which potentially utilizes a number of different sources of data. Now, I know you've done some Copper Rehab more recently, but that Vision Stream project, did you get to draw on much of the information that was stored in those preliminary OSSBSS there?
Yeah, obviously had some access when there was areas around design, access to Telstra systems, basically their inventory tool, but as well as a lot of the network data, MPAMs, and then also some of the logical inventory systems. So little bits of access, more drawing on that to be able to actually figure out and design network. But I still think one of the best things about working in that Copper Rehab program and also those Telstra programs was actually getting time out in the field. Mm. I think that really helped with my understanding of networks. It's a lot different when you get to see it out there in the field, see it out there in the pit and pipe, be in the exchanges, see the challenges around connectivity and inside plant. And then later on, that knowledge really helped in terms of being able to understand things like inventory and network management.
Oh, absolutely. I agree completely. It's one of the things that I do when new people are coming into the OSS or particularly the inventory space is to try and really give them some context about the network. So it's one thing to build the data into these tools, but obviously you really need to understand what that data means. And that only comes with the context of potentially going out on site and looking at some of the products, the networks, the connectivity and so forth. But so tell us too, perhaps for people who don't know what Copper Rehab is.
You know, obviously it's maintenance around that network, you know, especially in a lot of countries where they're now focusing on fiber delivery. They have an aging copper network that, you know, is prone to various types of wear and tear. And those rehab programs are really there to improve performance, especially when we start talking about things like digital subscriber lines to the end customers. You know, we need to make sure that those copper assets are is running at the best performance possible. But then it's also a real balance about making sure that the investment that you throw into these is weighed up against the advantages and the benefits to the end customer.
Yeah, obviously for the guest that really crosses over those boundaries too, I guess, between some of the different OSSBSS systems. So it is the inventory and asset, but yes, it also crosses into assurance, crosses into line test and other areas as well.
Yeah, performance, understanding how it's actually working. And then also there's a lot of tools out there that can help identify issues that fall into the OSS piece, you know, whether it's TDR testing or line testing, being able to actually understand where potential faults are, where high areas of resistance and loss is occurring, and then being able to plan various types of rehabilitation activities, such as changing cables or inserting nodes or replacing joints.
If we go even further back than that, you came from a background in computer science. Your dad, Bob, has been fairly influential in the telco industry in Australia. Was he in any way responsible for you starting off in telco?
Completely responsible.
So you can blame him completely?
Completely. I always wanted to be a software developer in my youth, probably from the age of 12. I was developing applications. Software was definitely my love. Engineering and networks is definitely my father's love, but he was very helpful in my younger years when I was looking for work and put me into Vision Stream quite early, mainly just administrative and support tasks. But as I sort of progressed through my degree and was working within Vision Stream, got a lot more opportunities to get into network design and then found a bit of a love as well for the networking side. But, you know, in computer science, we do a fair bit of networking. Wasn't necessarily my favorite subject. But later on, I think just that hands-on experience, getting to know it, once I really got my head around it, then I actually really started to enjoy networks, especially the deployment side. But as I said before, I think I really, really found a niche in operations. Operations was a fantastic opportunity, but it was also really challenging. So I really enjoyed that. It was a bit of an endless task where design and construction can be project to project based. Which I really enjoyed. But to answer your question, he pushed me in there, and somewhere along the line, I managed to find a bit of cohesion between my two loves, between networks and software, and that really brought me to OSS and BSS.
Well, it is the perfect joint, really. It is software, it is networks, and running those networks, and I guess the businesses that run over the top of those two, which you've now developed that passion for business as well.
Yeah, definitely.
Right. So in those network operations days, as the in the systems management role with VisionStream, what sort of tools were you using back then?
Oh, geez, in the next-gen operations, which, mind you, it was VisionStream operations, so we did more than just next-gen. We had a couple of other networks that we would look after, including VicTrac and Transitway systems, so some intelligent transport systems. So, look, a lot of the stuff really early days were a lot of Lucent technology, SDH, WDM management systems, which were really eye-opening for me, getting my head around those kind of logical systems and how they worked and the intelligence around them, you know, I guess looking at these systems, being able to see them talking to the network and interrogating the network and giving us information back on how they were performing and issues. And then on the other side, a lot of optical OTDR systems, being able to pick faults in fibers, et cetera. And then a lot of SNMP as well with a lot of the Ethernet systems. So OpenView and related products. We also had a pager network, which had some of its own unique software, purpose-built software, which once again, really good to get exposure to those kind of systems as they're getting built and being able to give feedback to the vendors on how to improve those products and make them more efficient.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that I'm sure you would have really gained access to is a lot more of the actual data sets. So because you're working with so many different systems, for me, looking at the data just explains so much more about the network and the nuances of networks in each different scenario. What was your interest in data, or did you find the same sort of thing?
Oh, I think that's where I always looked, being someone who was very software and database familiar. A lot of the things that I either developed, helped develop, or used to come up with answers always derived from data. So being able to access either raw data exports from those systems and then process them, you know, using my own tools, really made life a lot easier in terms of managing those networks for me and our operations department. I'm a very data-driven person. So, yeah, there was problems out there in terms of being able to identify where assets were, you know, what they were being used for, where they were living in capacity, also where they were in terms of capacity. And, you know, that data, being able to, you know, build threshold queries and analyze that data to figure out where it had been moved from, or even you know, being able to go back to vendors and identify specific assets that had failed several times in the network and being able to hand that information back to vendors saying, yeah, we don't want this card back in our network. This is clearly having issues. Doesn't matter where we put it or how many times you fix it. This card needs to go.
And some really specific use cases in there too. And so maybe a little bit more background on NextGen is that it's one of the really, it plays a really important role in the Australian telco landscape because it has a really extensive long-haul fibre network that really helps with some of the other larger and smaller carriers to fill in black spots and provide resilient links. In some ways, it's probably the insurance policy for the telco industry in Australia. But also, I guess that meant that you weren't as heavily funded as the big boys, so you must have been doing a lot with a little, both in terms of filling in the gaps with some of the tooling that you had, but also having some really, really important use cases that perhaps are a little bit different from some other carriers.
Yeah, definitely. And NextGen was challenged in terms of its timing and when it completed. You know, there was quite a large telco downturn just as NextGen was being completed. We had a fair number of other telecommunications companies struggling financially, and NextGen also suffered that, where they went into receivership and then were later bought out or saved by Latents. But in those really early days, there was just not much money to go around. So it was this amazingly large network with very few customers, very little revenue. So we had to find workarounds and build our own tools and find ways of maintaining the network really on a shoestring budget in those early days. So once again, those challenges bring great opportunity and fantastic learnings. But definitely in those early days of NextGen, their budgets were extremely tight. And a lot of their investment would go into new customers and new network, and operations would usually be just keep her alive,
OSS is the afterthought as usual.
Yeah. So, yeah. But with those challenges, as I said, comes great opportunity to be innovative and develop things yourself and find ways to implement new ideas directly rather than engaging with vendors and taking stuff off the shelf.
Mm. That's a really good segue too. So you've spent quite a bit of time in operation centers, but you also ended up taking on some role for some important system implementation projects for NextGen too, didn't you?
Yeah, well, one of the biggest ones was, of course, ConnectMaster, which was their inventory tool. And with my experience with their previous inventory tool, and my experience too in, I guess, maintaining that gap when we didn't really have a solution using, a lot of ad hoc tools that I'd created. It was a really good fit for me to come in there and run that project, which ended up being quite successful. We set up a really comprehensive inventory system that had logical and physical network. And then that was really my start into implementation and working on the vendor side. The vendor at the time, Pitney Bowes, and the product was Dynamic Design. My career pretty much progressed from the success of that implementation and basically then led all implementations in Australia and Asia from then on.
Yeah, and it really shaped the next few years of your career in the industry too.
Yeah, definitely. And as I said, I was with Pitney Bowes for a couple of years until Dynamic Design decided to start up their own venture here in Australia. And then I was fortunate enough that they chose me to start that up and run that. And, it was a really successful company. I think when we started, we had about 3 customers in Australia, and by the end we had around 12 in Australia and Asia Pacific. So it was quite a great opportunity. I think it's one of those things that I always tell you, Ryan, with operational systems, that it's the implementation that's the most important piece. If you can get that right, then you'll get value out of the tool.
Yeah, and one of the things I really feel is, as part of that implementation, often the part that's overlooked is the non-technical part. It's the people part. It's the change management part, which I'm sure you would have had some fantastic experience around.
Yeah, it's definitely, there's a number of different components that make a successful implementation. One of them, is data and data quality, which is probably one of the most important pieces to getting it up and running and ensuring you've got a product that is better than what they had before. Because if you don't have that product that's better than, the current tool sets or the current data, you'll struggle to get the users onto it. But that brings me over to the second part is the users themselves, ensuring that you've got, I often call them champions of the system, people who want to take accountability for the tools, are passionate about the tool and ensuring its success and making sure that you've got those leaders within your business that can drive the improvement within the tool and can drive better data quality and can ensure that the rest of the business has got the same quality and to actually populate that data and get the system working the way that you need it to.
Mm-hmm. Before moving on to ConnectMaster, you'd already used SpatialNet, the Synchronos product, and Small World, the GE product. Did that make the transition over to Pitney Bowes and the use of ConnectMaster relatively easy for a clever guy like you?
Oh, well, yeah, SpatialNet was a great experience. It was quite in its in its infancy when it went into NextGen, and it wasn't ready for fiber networks back in those days. It was very much a coax based or a HFC based system. So it had some issues around being able to map and model, you know, splicing and that kind of connectivity. But then in going through that cycle, I was able to really get a good look under the hood with the developers as we were explaining to the SpatialNet people. It wasn't Synchronos back in those days, but it was a great opportunity to have a look under the hood and explain and see how these things are developed, you know, writing the user stories and the use cases to how the system needed to operate, and then seeing that come to fruition through development, through their development. So, yeah, unfortunately, that one didn't work, but they obviously opened the door up when they purchased ConnectMaster, you know, for me to go through the same routine again. I'd already had the experience, really got a good picture of how these things worked. And then also, like you touched on, accessing systems like Telstra's P&I and MITS and MIDS, you know, being able to then take that experience and map it into another tool was really helpful.
Mm. And again, I guess it comes back to the understanding of the networks. You understand the networks and the way that some tools model things, and it becomes the easier transition to move on to the next one, but always a hell of a lot of nuances to learn on the new systems as well.
Yeah, and I think that's the interesting thing about inventory is, you know, its main objective or its core objective is to represent a real-world object and a component via data and via a logical structure, so or a software structure. So taking into consideration what you actually need to understand from that model, you know, really drives the way that you actually model it. So there's you know, a lot of shortcuts that you can take and a lot of balancing that you can take in terms of, you know, ease of creation inside the system versus the information you get out. That's I need to get out of it. So that's the real, you know, whenever I'm doing any kind of, you know, modeling, especially in inventory, really speaking to the customers around what do they need about this object? What do you really need to know about this object, and what level of detail do we need to go to? Because the more level of detail you go to in the model, often the more complicated it is to configure it and work with it later on. So finding that balance is a real key to a successful implementation. Once again, you want to make it easier for the users, not harder.
Yeah, absolutely. It's what I refer to as MVD, or minimum viable data. It just means that there's less to maintain, less to get out of sync, etc. And but I guess, too, you touched on speaking with the users, and inventory actually has a number of different users. So it's the designers, the capacity planners, the outside plant, or the field workforce team that gets given design packs. So it touches a lot more places than people might think.
Oh, that's right. So it's you know, I might be a bit biased, but I consider inventory to be the core of an OSS.
Absolutely.
You know, this is where all the information is stored about, you know, the asset that you're working with, which is your network.
And the available resources that you can assign to customers.
Yeah, and everything, you know, it covers, like you said before, it covers the life cycle of that inventory from, you know, planning all the way up to operations and decommission. So being able to make sure that you can cover all those bases, support everyone from the people who are trying to sell the network all the way to the people who are out there in the field maintaining it.
Mm. And as we talked about, ConnectMaster was really a theme for a few years for you. So to follow the bouncing ball, you started with ConnectMaster as the customer side with NextGen. You then transitioned to ConnectMaster, which was under Pitney Bowes at that stage, and then onto ConnectMaster with Dynamic Design Australia, so starting up the Australian subsidiary. Are you able to talk about how those steps came about, and particularly the last one, the starting up of the Australian subsidiary?
To a degree, long time ago, so it's sort of hard to remember. But no, look, the transition into Pitney Bowes was quite logical one from them, from what I understood when they approached me. That was that there wasn't a huge amount of expertise in the industry, especially with this product. There was only really two customers of it. NextGen had been really successful, and the other customer was still struggling to get their implementation off the ground. Pitney Bowes were under a fair bit of pressure to deliver that, and it seemed like a really logical choice to get someone on who obviously had success in that area and understood the product really well to make sure that they could support their new customers. So that was really the transition to Pitney Bowes, and then, you know, the other moving over to dynamic design was really a dynamic design decision there. They were very European based at that stage. They enjoyed working with me when I was within NextGen and within Pitney Bowes. And, you know, eventually they made a decision to actually set up a base here as well. So once again, probably being the lead technical person in the system with a fair bit of management experience, we found a opportunity for us to work together and build up the business here in Australia.
Very important. And it's interesting how often that happens too, that because there are so many vendors out there, and you almost have to do an apprenticeship to learn each new tool. So even if you know inventory, there's still that apprenticeship period while you learn ConnectMaster, for example. And because there aren't a lot of people out there, often the vendors also struggle to find people, especially on short notice, that have already done that apprenticeship. So, yeah, it's a really common theme, those stepping stones that you went through there.
Yeah, and it was a real challenge for Pitney Bowes as well in those days, because, you know, the amount of hands-on time they had with the system during those implementations was minimal, you know. So, you know, I was probably in a slightly more advantageous period that during NextGen, you know, I was solely responsible for getting this system up, and therefore I actually spent a fair bit of time understanding the tool, as well as my colleagues as well, understanding the tool, how it would work and how we would stand the system up, you know, using it day in and day out for a year during that implementation. Definitely gave me a really good footing to be able to take that tool into any business and set it up the right way.
And I guess as Managing Director of Dynamic Design Australia, you'd already implemented projects, obviously, but now the buck very much stopped with you as MD. That must have been represented a whole new set of learnings and accountabilities for you as well.
Yeah, and we were very small in terms of just the Australian base. I think at our largest, we had about 6 or 7 employees. So, but in the real early days, it was just 2 to 3 of us, depending on where we were at in terms of growth and customers. But so, yeah, when you are such a small business, like a lot of small businesses, you know, the managing director is a nice title, but the reality was, you know, we were a bit of a 1- and 2-man army in those days. Yeah, the accountability, not just on the implementation side, but running the business. And running the business piece was something I actually also really enjoyed, getting my head around various intricacies of business management.
Management, sales, development, et cetera,
financial management, contractual management, you know, and that really set me up even now for my role in GQI, which is a much larger company, but having all that management experience, understanding how a business operates and the key things it needs to survive and to grow, you know, they were great learnings from dynamic design.
And funnily enough, I really feel that makes you a stronger OSSBSS practitioner as well, because the tools that we develop are for the full operations of a telco or a network operator, which does touch on the sales team, the marketing team, the field workforce, all of the other pieces that make up a telco generally have some sort of dependency on the tools or the data that we work with.
Yeah, definitely. And probably more in my role here with GQI, where there's a bit more advisory consulting, being able to have such a large breadth of knowledge from the end-to-end of a business, but of a telco, really helps support various consulting activities. But yeah, definitely in the OSS space, when you can talk to the salespeople about and understanding their challenges, but then also be able to talk to the field workers about, you know, their challenges, you know, definitely makes that end-to-end implementation and understanding what such a vast user group requires, it definitely makes it a lot easier. And I think I generally find people appreciate speaking to either consultants or implementation specialists when they actually understand what they need, and when they raise, you know, requirements about what they want from their tool sets, that they've got someone who's listening to that, who actually understands it and can communicate back. Oh, so you're looking for a report that looks like this. Would you want to be able to understand this kind of information or that kind of information, and actually then progress them to coming up with more effective ideas as well?
And just having the empathy for the challenges they face and the tasks that they do, as opposed to sitting in the ivory tower, perhaps, of assuming you know what they do.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly right.
It's fair to say, too, that you had full accountability because you were delivering and implementing for customers, but you still weren't completely master of your own destiny, were you? Because the products were really developed out of head office of dynamic design. The roadmap was partially in your control. Final customer and pricing sign-offs even had to come from HQ, did they?
Yeah, to a degree, yes, definitely. So, you know, we didn't do much development until later on in, you know, my time at Dynamic Design. Eventually, we did bring on a couple of developers who worked specifically on the API part of the platform. Mm. And that was really because a lot of the synchronization pieces were getting driven out of Australia.
Extension into IPM, PLS network capability and things like that as well. You had a fairly strong hand in, didn't you?
Yeah, definitely. And that, a lot of that, you know, I think one of the challenges that I found early was, you know, how do I broach it with the business about investing in a new module or a new functionality in the system with that, if we build it, they will come type scenario, and which doesn't really fly with too many businesses. But then also, you know, I found it a lot easier, you know, when customers are driving that as well. So a lot of that then came to actually, you know, marketing to customers and explaining to customers about modules and products we could develop. But then that also came from their needs as well. A lot of a lot of good software products get developed by their customers, you know, what they need and what kind of problems and challenges they have. They end up driving that roadmap. So, you know, it was really, you know, we set up a number of things around user forums and various types of customer engagement programs that enabled us to then really document these problems, but then be able to put a monetary value on it back to the business and say, well, you know, if we build this for customer A, we also know customer B and C will buy it as well, but, you know, we can get some funding for it up front. We can prioritize it. So, there's definitely, you know, there's a technical aspect that I'd found in software in the really early days that I wanted to build it all. But the reality is, you know, it really does, software really does need to be driven on a need. No point building a piece of software that, you know, might not get the value out of it.
Yeah, it's a real delicate balance as well, isn't it? The developing to a roadmap versus developing to a specific customer pain point that they're screaming out for right at this point, but doesn't necessarily fit in the long-term strategy. But also, yeah, that development effort versus the revenue from developing a new function or a new module.
Yeah, that's right. You know, at the end of the day, this is a business. You have to, you know, any investment you put in, you want to make sure that you've got a return. So, you know, for me, it was about doing my due diligence around, you know, the value of the development investment and ensuring that, you know, if we did build stuff, I could sell it.
And not even just that, I guess it's even the relevance to the customer. So they, in almost every case I've dealt with, the customer always wants some extra features, and being software, it's so easy to think, okay, we can add this, we can add this. But it's really important to identify the things that the customer actually needs, so you're not wasting time. I guess it's that opportunity cost of development effort.
Oh yeah, and look at customers. You know, specific individuals within a business can have some really detailed requirements, or they could be looking for things that they think are really, really important, because that's, you know, through their optics, you know, this is a really important piece. But then the value of developing something like that versus the value of the value of that to the employee can sometimes not weigh up. I had plenty of examples where, you know, I'd learned from experience in these where we'd have requests from customers where they'd say, hey, we want feature A that does this, can give me a report on this, you know, operational incident that might happen. And we'd build these things and then we'd find out that the customer never used them. They'd pay for them, but then there wasn't any value for the second or third customer, which is what you'd always want in these software pieces. You want to, when you've got an agnostic product, you want to make sure that anything you build specific to one customer can then be transitioned over to another customer and on sold to multiple customers. So there needs to be value in it for everyone. And if we did find there were times where we would build specific pieces for specific customers that we probably hadn't done our due diligence around whether the value was actually there for them. And what we find is we have little disparate functionality that would not be getting used by anyone, which was, if it wasn't for the value for the person that actually wanted it, there's no value for it for anyone else either. So, making sure that we take the customer through that journey of where is the value here for it. And a lot of times there'd be some really good ideas, but then, when we really flushed it out, you'd find there could be instances where, all right, well, this incident happens two or three times a year and it's really important to be able to get an answer within an hour or something like that. And maybe it's taking them 3 hours to actually get the answer. But then when you find out that to store the data and capture the data is going to cost you an extra 5 minutes a day for the entire year, then all of a sudden that value goes out the door and it doesn't take the customer long to figure out once it's been implemented that hold on a minute, I'm still better off, for those couple of times a year spending the 3 hours to solve that problem. Or even finding ways to reduce that rather than come up with a full solution. What kind of reporting can we do to make that a 2-hour task rather than a 3-hour, and trying to find that balance between effort and reward.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess that even potentially dilutes the experience for the user, because if they've got functionality that neither that customer or any of the other customers really use, it means there's an extra menu item in the GUI that just makes things more confusing, reduces the intuitiveness of the interface as well. But then it's also the ongoing costs, both for on the customer side for maintenance of data or whatever, but also on your side, the maintenance of the code base and the extra complexity of doing additional regression testing or just testing of the functionality, how it works with that new code snippet.
Yeah, exactly right. When you're talking about a platform as complicated as a network inventory system, they're all very complicated. There's always a lot of options, a lot of reporting, a lot of features, a lot of functionality. The more that you build, the more structures you have to build around the UI to make sure that it's easy to access. People aren't searching menus trying to find, where's that report or where's that function. So it's once again a real balance, making sure that you don't put in so many features that are disparately around the system that it becomes clunky and painful to use. And that's a real trap that a lot of software products, especially in the complicated engineering space, that's often a pitfall that they'll fall into, where the application will be very hard to pick up because it is so, there's so many options and there's so many features and functions. And the really good software companies out there do find ways to simplify it.
Or raise it up to the next level. So it might be specific functionality for one customer, but if you can abstract it to an extent and be able to support multiple similar functionalities for multiple customers, often that's not really, or that's hard to implement as well.
It's doable, but it's definitely challenging.
That software in a nutshell, isn't it? It's doable. Yeah. So I guess I have a saying of just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Exactly right. No, I completely agree with that.
Now, we talked a little bit about some of the really important features that you fast-tracked in the roadmap, such as the APIs and IPMPLS. Was there anything else that you really took customer feedback on board and actually brought that through to product roadmap?
Oh, that's a really good question. Look, there was a number of things. I think things like audit flow was another really important one, being able to understand where and what had been touched in terms of data, who had touched it last, et cetera. That was a really important module that we'd driven. A lot of design automation as well. Yeah, I think the biggest one which we pushed quite hard with was the data synchronization engines would probably be the largest one. And from my very early days in NextGen, I'd written one of these to pull out the entire SDH structure of the technology and basically written my own synchronization piece. And the value in that, in terms of being able to talk to the active network, get an understanding of network topology as well as device location and device hierarchy, being able to pull that in and know that data's right and compare it then against the information that has been either manually put in or synchronized with this tool actually gives you a huge amount of opportunity for data correction and data quality. So those data synchronization engines are probably the most important piece, from what I believe, of making sure that, especially even your passive network infrastructure, the cables and joints and patch panels that can't talk back to you, if you have some level of logic that you know is right, you can use that information to validate the physical. So, you know, some great reports and some great features inside the KinectMaster product with these synchronization engines will allow you to figure out, once you've uploaded all your information and you know that your logic and all your active equipment is correct, you can then interrogate the physical network and say, well, do I have a multiplex section or an aggregate path that doesn't have full connectivity through a cable network? So, and then, you know, when you can identify those spots of bad data or missing data, you can often, you know, I've often found, especially through these implementations, that there are pockets of bad information. So you'll find one and you'll see that that affects, you know, it'll be maybe a cable or a joint that wasn't properly updated during some sort of maintenance or construction exercise, and that will affect heaps of services and heaps of other related pieces. So you fix that one pocket and you actually end up fixing a whole lot. So that sort of goes back to the 80-20 rule that we always talk about, you know, focusing on that 20% that gives you the 80% of the value.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think the first discovery engine that I built or helped work on was back in around 2000-2001, and it only dawned on me a little bit later than that by doing the discovery and reconcile engine, that actually became a really important part of the data migration strategy. So instead of having to do an extract out of those NMS or EMS, that you could actually suck it into the database, knowing that it should have been fairly right because EMS and NMS were also reconciling that data. Yeah, that became a really important part now of when I put together a data migration strategy, is always try and look at building the discovery engines first and what else you can build around it, rather than trying to extract and then import that data as a base case or the baseline and then building your discovery and reconcile after.
Yeah, any kind of transition-based project, you know, that transition or that migration, A, they're always probably the most important piece, but B, there's a lot of opportunity in there. We always found, and we wrote a fair amount of algorithms and queries and functions that would validate that data on the way through. And this was a really good value add for these kind of solutions that, depending on where they were sitting and how good the data was, or how well related it was in their existing tools, and often these would be spreadsheets or CAD files or map info files, etc. You know, we brought them all into a single data set before we migrated, and that was always our migration strategy. Bring it in somewhere first, rationalize it, try and fix as much of it as possible, and then work with the customer as well quite collaboratively in terms of saying, hey, we can see you've got huge amounts of missing data here, 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 and here. Now they might sort that out with audits, or they might have other bits of information that they could give us to correct that. But there's a great opportunity before you plug it into the system during migration where you can try and correct as much of that data as possible. And then that also leads, you know, to a really good user experience. If you know, the things that they're using today, when it transitions over to the new tool, if they can see the old one, they knew the holes and they knew the gaps in the old information tools, and then they see in the new one that a lot of those problems are fixed, you get a really good user experience, and therefore you get really positive user interactions and user buy-in. Mm. You know, they want to use the system because it is now making their job easier, which is your main objective and your main goal with any implementation. We want to make sure that at the end of this, people's jobs are easier. We're receiving the cost benefits in reduced time and efficiencies, and we're seeing better accuracy. And that better accuracy flows into, you know, less truck rolls and fixes and issues out in the field when we're building new stuff, and customer outages because we were playing with the network that we didn't realize services were running through that infrastructure because it wasn't properly documented. So if you can fix those problems, they're really good value hits that not only please the management but make the lives of the people who are actually doing that, from sales to field work, actually makes their jobs easier, and then you really do get that buy-in for the tool.
Yeah, really important point too. So it's not just doing a blind import of data, but it's doing the validation. And one of the things that people often underestimate or just not aware of is the ripple out implications of having bad data from some of that, particularly the inventory system, particularly physical network inventory. So it's almost like if the bottom of the stack, if you think like an OSI type stack where you've got the physical infrastructure at the bottom, everything ripples out from that.
Completely right. You know, it's your data is fact. So, you know, you want to make sure that it's right. So that's where you're going to base all your decisions around. And if it's wrong, or if it's not accurate or it's missing, that leads to bad decisions and that leads to bad outcomes. So, you know, I think we touched on it at the start. You know, data is being really data-driven in OSS is really important. But being data-driven is more than just having lots of data. It's having good quality data.
Well, and knowing what questions to ask of the data as well. That comes later, but since we're talking about implementation, we're talking about the building of those data sets initially.
Yeah, you need to know what you want to get out of it later to make sure that the data set's comprehensive enough to give you the answers that you need. So, you know, that's almost, although you sort of said it's at the end of the process, a lot of it is actually at the start of the process where you
work back.
You work backwards and say, well, what do we need out of this? Oh, you want to make sure you can do capacity planning. Great. Right. Well, we need to be storing these variables and these pieces of information. You want to know shared infrastructure. How do you want to map that? Do you have things like shared fiber agreements? A company that has fiber swapping arrangements will have different models to someone that doesn't. If they do just
net leases and stuff.
Understanding will you ever go down this track? Do we need to keep that door open? Or are you specifically a company that will never do these kind of things? Because we can simplify it and we can model things in a different way based on understanding what you're going to need out of this data, not just now, but potentially in the future.
And even weighted routing and things like that, so that you can put services through the things that are going to cost you the least, or whichever your preferred model is to be able to route.
Absolutely. Yeah, if you want to do those algorithms, you know, we need to make sure that we've got those attributes to measure where's your preferred decision making going to sit.
And so you've worked on a number of different implementations. Who were the primary stakeholders or customers, and what did you really have to do for them to allow them to thrive?
So specific customers?
Oh, just in general. So what were some of the observations you found about what did you need to do for them to allow them to thrive? So maybe that is in answering it for some specific cases, or perhaps it's for some more generic cases over the top of that.
Usually a lot of the drive, you know, and you've probably seen this a fair bit in OSS, is that a lot of the drive would come from operations. They see the need and they see the challenges. Unfortunately, a lot of the investment only comes when there's problems, which is often, you know, I don't want to say it's too late, but it's often a fair way down the street in terms of, you know, probably being proactive and implementing these things to prevent these problems from happening, because there's a fair lead time in getting them up and running, and then there's a fair lead time in getting the data right.
Well, and so, the lead time that precedes that in just getting internal approvals and budget allocated, et cetera. So tend to be multi-year projects, don't they?
Yeah, and unfortunately it's not until, you know, especially in the carrier or even in the utility space that we work quite heavily in, it's usually not till there's been some really costly event that could have paid for an inventory system four times over that management start to make those decisions. So in terms of the stakeholders, you always obviously need management buy-in, but I've also found that ensuring that understanding what's driving this is and the problems that they need to be solved are met during an implementation. But then the other key stakeholders that usually push it is the operations team, your NOx and your field staff, et cetera. But then also as it progresses and the systems, not as they come up, but definitely the interest starts to grow from more of the front of house as well, as these tools are either initialized or you know, even in the early stages of implementation, you know, I'd always try and make sure I reached out to sales and pre-sales areas, people who are going to need to plan the network, and also the planning and design departments who would also drive some of this stuff. But they'd be your key areas, sales, planning and design, operations and management would probably be the four main areas that would really drive what they're looking for.
Yeah, I agree completely. Often we get a little bit too focused on the O and the OSS, so a little bit too focused on just operations, but our value to add to so many other parts of the business is so important that sometimes we lose sight of it and come myopic on just what we need to do for operations.
Yeah, and when you can do some of the stuff that we've been able to achieve with sales and even design and planning, probably more specifically with ConnectMaster, but not just that product. But yeah, being able to give them the insights and the information to price things up better. And if you're making less assumptions around how much it's going to cost you to build something, you can be a lot more aggressive on your pricing. And you know, that leads to more revenue and more deals and opportunity.
Yeah, even identifying areas to serve or segments to serve and all sorts of different things that we can add to other parts of the business.
Yeah, being able to, you know, it's a real effective piece for a salesperson to be able to understand exactly what equipment and services are available immediately in a site, and then, you know, how far away it would be to bring in other services that might be, you know, two or three doors down.
Yeah, and also a little bit earlier you touched on that you did quite a bit of work in the utility space, and you also did quite a bit of work through the Asian region, winning some really important projects there. Did you find that there were many significant differences between not just the different cultures that you worked within, but different corporate cultures, different segment cultures even across your account?
Yeah, look, I think the utility space is really really eye-opening. They definitely have a stronger operational focus in telecommunications, mainly because, you know, when we do deal with power companies or rail companies or companies that have, you know, various regulations around health and safety.
Much more risk management around them.
Yeah, so they tend to be a lot more, you know, focused in ensuring that these problems don't come up and that they aren't exposed to risks around, you know, these kind of things. And so therefore their responsiveness and their willingness to invest is a bit higher than sometimes the telcos are. Telcos are usually a bit more focused on revenue and sales. And
services, yeah.
Services and sales. So yeah, there's definitely a cultural piece there, and that probably comes to also how you sell the product, who you talk to and what features you really amplify, but also in terms of your implementation, making sure that there's a focus on, you know, what this customer needs versus what a commercial customer needs versus a utility or a government company, you know, is really important to acknowledge. And that often also then folds into the detail to how you model and how you report and where the focuses are in the system. So yeah, definitely in those two pieces, there was a large difference. You know, in Asia, it was, you know, I think there was always a lot of excitement around tools in Asia. Some countries were more interested in, you know, just making sure that they had a database or a place where they could store all their information than they were about the efficiencies. That's probably more of a cultural driver. Others were looking for those efficiencies, just depending on where you're working in the Asian area. Yeah, we definitely find, you know, different cultures in there. You know, all of them definitely had the same needs as the operators over here in terms of what they needed to manage, but just some of the drivers were slightly different.
Yeah, one of the things I found really, really valuable working across different cultures and corporate cultures is the ability to take away different learnings from different ones and say, okay, this worked really well over at this customer and it works really badly over here, so I'll take the best of each of those and just add that to the overall mix. So personally, I found it really valuable for learning how to do implementation better.
Yeah, no, definitely. And a lot of similarities too in some of these companies around technologies that they're using. And once again, that can, especially with ConnectMaster, it did drive a lot of our roadmap. You know, a lot of the power utilities use PDH technology for various reasons. And I think a lot of them now are switching.
Yeah. MPLS tends to be more of the transition just going ahead now.
But back when we were doing it, there was a lot of emphasis on a technology that you know, we would have considered to be on its way out or becoming quite obsolete, but we were making a large number of enhancements to our PDH and time division features inside the system to be able to, you know, meet the requirements. But then once again, when you've got a nice, consistent customer base that are all sharing the same challenges, it's a lot easier to invest in those enhancements and additional features.
Yeah, I agree completely around that. In fact, that was one of the things I found really fascinating about working with utilities is, I guess, a lot of OSS companies really focus on the bleeding edge or the crashing edge of the wave, where I really feel like there's still a lot of opportunities for some customers on the trailing edge of the wave to just service them better. And the good thing about the trailing edge of the wave is you've already spent years working with it. It's more mature, it's more understood. The way to implement is probably better understood as well. So I feel like there's quite a bit of opportunity in an area that a lot of vendors don't really focus on, focusing so much on the bleeding edge.
Yeah, a lot of this stuff does too come down to reliability. You know, I know for a fact there's certain equipment types that are very old out there, and I've been working in those companies, help setting up these systems and looking at various pieces of data, and I've seen boxes that have been out of the site for, you know, 5-8 years without a second of downtime because of their reliability. And you don't tend to find that with a lot of new equipment. Mm. It's more complicated and more layered, but, you know, a lot of these were old but reliable, and if that's what the customer needs, there's always opportunity there to build solutions specific to that niche market.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. And eventually, I guess, Dynamic Design Australia was thriving so much that headquarters wanted to buy you back. So that must have been a really nice feeling, a vindication of the hard work that you've been putting in.
Yeah, no, that's right. I think, they sold to VirtGIS, so I think the solution's fully sold. But yeah, it was a really good vindication. It was one of the most successful parts of our business. We helped set up the international strategy outside of Europe, not just in Australia, but in the US, and as I said before, Asia Pacific. And then in terms of a customer base, we have, you know, some of the best and the largest and most comprehensive implementations here in Australia. So yeah, it was really good to be bought back out of the company, obviously getting the opportunity with GQI after that.
Yeah, and you've taken up a role as a director and a stakeholding in GQI, one of Australia's boutique system integrators and consultancy firms. Are you able to tell us a little bit about what GQI does and whether it's opened up a broader remit for you to tackle now, even above what you were doing as MD of DDA?
Oh, definitely. We're very much a consulting organisation for telecommunications. We're very niche to ICT. We do a little bit of IT, but most of that IT definitely sits more in the OSS and BSS sides, but it's a much broader remit than what I had in Dynamic Design. So, you know, when I'm doing sales for GQI, it's pretty much whatever your problem or solution, the problem that you're looking to solve or solution that you're looking to implement. If it's got something to do with telecommunications, we can help. So that goes from advisory, strategy, economics, systems, design, deployment, everything. So it's a very broad piece, but yeah, definitely quite eye-opening for me as well. The consulting piece, which you're a bit more familiar with than I am, it's a different structure that's given me great opportunities to learn and grow, which I'm always looking for as an individual.
And I guess supporting too the telco industry in a fairly heavy way, that because you have such a deep understanding and empathy for what telco operators go through and integrators go through, you can probably see all of the pieces of the puzzle that come together. And now that you've got more tools at your disposal, people, process, tech, that you can bring to the broader problems must make it quite interesting.
Yeah, being able to go, we've got some companies that we'll deal with where we're delivering a range of software advisory services. So some of that would still include things like inventory, but when we can map that over to service management, network management, as well as strategic consulting about where we should be deploying, your network, where you're going to get the best value, really bringing these pieces of information together and coming up with some really comprehensive advisory but also helping support them in terms of becoming efficient and more innovative is, it's a much larger piece, but we still do some inventory in there, but it's definitely opens our eyes up a bit more when we get the opportunity to support network management and service management as well.
Yeah, and also out to the workforce management as well, and many facets of that, and how to build and maintain, and you know, all those great things about the network as well.
Yeah, optimizing workforce, making it easier for the workforce to understand the jobs that they have to do. And like I said, a lot of this stuff will come from inventory and service management type solutions. But yeah, workforce management is another really exciting piece that we do a fair amount of work in as well.
And because it's so scaled, usually that's where you get just the smallest of improvements can give massive optimization benefit.
Oh, yeah, completely. And there's such a great array of tools out there. And I think that's the other piece that I've really enjoyed being in quite a vendor agnostic or independent business, is that I'm not just pinned to single products. We can go out and we can advise around all the products in the market, do market analysis that helps us understand the tools a lot more in a lot more detail. Also, you know, gives us the opportunity to work with several tools should we be asked to implement them as well, which we do. So it's for someone who loves software, I really enjoy the opportunity to work with new tools and new tool sets. And although I do sit at the top of the company, I do find myself working with many of our staff who specialize in these systems and taking a look under the hood and getting to know the nuts and bolts. So I
can't keep your fingers out of the pie.
Can't help myself sometimes, but yeah, I just, as I said, being exposed to so many products is really exciting as well.
Yeah, so maybe one of those that I know about is an implementation you did around Node-RED. Maybe you could talk a little bit about how interesting that was.
Yeah, so we did a big implementation for NBN in Node-RED. So basically what this tool would do, it was a scalable tool that would talk to the network, understand various events that would come in, and then provide an interface to build various types of automation, mainly
around
their
originates. So Node-RED is primarily used for more as a home automation type tool, isn't it? But you
exactly
repurposed.
Right. Yeah, repurposed it into a tool that would interrogate the network, but then also provide that level of automation around what do we do with these events? How do we handle them? And, you know, a lot of that would work initially with things like digital twins, that we could then throw various events into the product and start to build up a library and a knowledge base of common events, how they might be triaged, how they might be acted upon, and then push that out into production. So, you know, that's really heading towards those zero-touch networks that we often talk about. And, you know, you get a lot from your automation. You don't just get the efficiency gains from not having to touch the data or the outcomes or the things that are happening during that process, but you get the accuracy as well. So, you know, providing your automations are well validated and well verified, you know, you don't make the human error anymore. You know, there's no keystroke issues. There's no closing something when it should have been opened. That automation ensures that things are accurate as well as fast.
Yeah, and I found it a really interesting decision because it is a bit left field. I hadn't really heard of Node-RED being used in the context of telco before, but having seen some of the visual workflows and some of those kind of things that Node-RED offers, it was really, really interesting to me.
And scalability was an issue too. We did a fair amount of work in the cloud infrastructure and Amazon Web Services to build something that was scalable, that was still fast and effective. So it's one is the tool and the other is the foundation that you build them on. So there's some really smart people in our organization who know how to bring those things together, fortunately. seeing some of the end product there was really impressive.
So getting towards the end, I guess we now do the looking forward, looking back section of the podcast. So since the theme of this episode has really been around the many challenges we face as OSS implementers, are there any major pitfalls for us to really look out for?
Pitfalls. Look, I think planning is everything. I can't put enough emphasis on planning an implementation or a transition and a migration for these pieces. Put the work in at the front end and you'll see the rewards at the back end. And that really comes down to making sure that understanding the requirements of what you're trying to deliver, really making sure that you're diligent in the way that you've written them down, ensure that there's strong communication with the stakeholders and the users around what these are and how they are defined and what success is going to look like. And like all good things, when you've got a good plan and you've got a good strategy, a lot of it will fall into line from there. That would be my main one. So, and then as I said, also, you know, taking those opportunities with migration and transitions that we talked about before would really, I think that's where you can add a lot of value as well.
Yeah, for sure. What do you feel the future holds for OSS Telco, and how are you specifically positioning for it, either in ops or beyond?
Look, I think there's definitely more automation coming in, machine learning and AI, although they're quite fuzzy terms. We're starting to see a lot of that coming to fruition with some products that can actually help make decisions and also learn. And
just handling the volume that, as humans, we can't possibly handle the volume that's now hitting our networks compared to, I guess, compare it and contrast it back to those early days at NextGen and VisionStream.
I don't see a network where there is going to be zero operation staff in there, where there's always going to be a need for technical SMEs and operations people on the phone, et cetera. But I do see an opportunity where their jobs can be a lot simpler. They can be easier to do, and that will come from a lot of automation, machine learning and AI, and a lot of good data analytics as well, being able to process large volumes of data and come up with the right answers quickly and easily so that operators can make the right decisions.
Are there any other pearls of wisdom that you've got for the listeners that maybe I haven't asked the questions specifically, but anything else that you'd love to share?
Oh, you've been very comprehensive, Brian. So I think you've hit all the right points. So really appreciate it.
Fantastic. It's been a delight to have you on. And if people wanted to continue the conversation, where would they be able to find you?
You could either reach me on LinkedIn or go to our website, www.gqi.com.au. Reach out to us there. I'm always happy to talk to anyone in this space or in the telecommunication space. Very social person in the telecommunication sector. So please feel free to reach out to me anytime.
Absolutely. I can completely attest to that statement. So Michael is completely open to talking with anyone and sharing ideas with anyone about this industry that we are so passionate about. So it's been a delight to have you on. Really appreciate all the insights that you've shared today, Michael.
Thank you very much, Ryan. Thank you for having me.
Been an absolute pleasure. And also thank you for the guests who've been listening in. And we look forward to getting another one of these episodes out to you shortly. Thanks for listening to the Passionate About OSS podcast. You can find more episodes, more than 2,500 blogs, and our contact details over at passionateaboutoss.com.